Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Wednesday, the 29th of January. Our main stories. President Trump has set out his long-awaited Middle East peace plan, saying it could be the last chance for an independent Palestinian state. The deal has been praised by Israel, but the Palestinians have strongly rejected it. President Xi Jinping says China is sure to beat the new coronavirus, despite growing criticism of the authorities. Also in the podcast.
The feeling that it could all fall apart, that was when I decided that I wasn't going to wait to one day get to the hospital and be told, look, we don't have the drugs.
Why a young man living with HIV fled Venezuela for Spain. The authorities in Lagos hope to reduce the city's traffic chaos by banning motorcycle taxis. And a fresh take on a 19th century classic novel.
This narrative is far more than mere fiction.
Are you David Copperfield?
I am indeed.
It is the true story of the life I was about to lead.
Your mama is ill.
How ill is she?
Very ill.
Dangerously ill.
She's dead.
It's the latest film version of Charles Dickens' David Copperfield. A win-win for Israel and the Palestinians. A realistic two-state solution with the Palestinians getting their own independent nation. Donald Trump has set out his so-called deal of the century to bring peace to the Middle East, where previous US presidents from Lyndon Johnson onwards had tried and bitterly failed. Mr. Trump said he was the man to succeed. However, even before he spoke, the Palestinians had dismissed the idea, saying it gave Israel the green light to create an apartheid state. Speaking at the White House, President Trump warned that the deal could be the last opportunity for the Palestinians to achieve independent statehood.
This map will more than double the Palestinian territory and provide a Palestinian capital in eastern Jerusalem where America will proudly open an embassy. No Palestinians or Israelis will be uprooted from their homes. Israel will work closely with a wonderful person, a wonderful man, the King of Jordan, to ensure that the status quo of the Temple Mount is preserved and strong measures are taken to ensure that all Muslims who wish to visit peacefully and pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque will be able to do so.
The president presumably referring to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, one of the holiest sites in Islam. There was also confusion about the future of Jerusalem. Mr. Trump said the city would be Israel's undivided capital. But at the same time, as we just heard, the Palestinians would have a capital in eastern Jerusalem. Standing alongside him and sharing the applause was the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Referring to the occupied West Bank by its biblical name of Judea and Samaria, he praised Mr. Trump for recognizing Israel's territorial gains in areas most other countries regard as Palestinian territory.
You recognize that Israel must have sovereignty in the Jordan Valley and in other strategic areas of Judea and Samaria. For too long, far too long, the very heart of the land of Israel, where our patriarchs prayed, our prophets preached, and our kings ruled, has been outrageously branded as illegally occupied territory. Well, today, Mr. President, you are puncturing this big lie. You are recognizing Israel's sovereignty over all the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria, large and small alike, as a permanent part of the Jewish state.
Well, we'll hear Palestinian reaction in a moment, but first I asked Gary O'Donoghue in Washington what were the key points of the plan.
Well, I think the question of refugees was a very key point. No right of return for refugees to Israel. That's been a big bone of contention for the Palestinians. They'll have to be resettled either in their new state or in other third-party countries. Israel will retain security control over all the areas right up to the the Jordan River and elsewhere in the West Bank. So you might ask yourself, if the Palestinians get a state, then what kind of a state is it if you don't control your borders? The question of Jerusalem, again, very blurred. He said Eastern Jerusalem would be a place for the Palestinian capital. The White House's note that they've released talks about East Jerusalem. And East Jerusalem would include the holy sites. Eastern Jerusalem probably wouldn't. So very unclear what's going on there. But overall, given the Palestinians aren't even here, this is very much a deal for Israel.
Yes, this plan has been a long time in the making. Why has it been announced now?
Well, if you're a cynic, you'd say this is a distraction from domestic political problems for President Trump here with his impeachment trial, and for Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, where, of course, he's not just fighting corruption charges, he's also facing a third election in a year to try and build himself a coalition that he can govern with. Others, I think, would say, look, every president has tried to do this. Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, has been working on it for 3 years, and now is the time that it's come to some kind of fruition. But there's no doubt there are political benefits for both Washington and for the incumbent prime minister in Israel for announcing it right now.
Do they really think they can get a breakthrough the White House?
Well, I mean, the president says he anticipates the Palestinians will reject it in the short term, but will come to realise it's a good idea. He is, in some sense, stuffing their mouths with gold, don't forget, offering $50 billion worth of investment, which is something that's, you know, been up front, if you like, in this whole deal right from the beginning. I wonder whether that will be enough to persuade them to go along with this deal.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. Well, the Palestinians weren't at the White House to hear Mr. Trump set out his vision, but shortly afterwards, the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas rejected the proposal, calling it a conspiracy which will not pass. Tim Franks got more reaction from Hussam Zomlot, the Palestinian ambassador in London.
That was a scam, really. It has nothing to do with deals or plans or peace, for that matter. It was really a political circus. Peace is very well known. The parameters for it has been established by the international order. The world has really required from us to recognize the two-state solution, to recognize Israel. And the path was very well crafted until President Trump has killed three birds with one lethal stone. The first bird was the prospects of a negotiated two-state solution, because there will not be an Israeli prime minister in the future who would negotiate a genuine peace if Netanyahu has just pocketed Jerusalem, the refugees, the borders, all the settlements, and the Jordan Valley. And the second bird that President Trump killed today is international system itself, the post-Second World War rules-based order that has been established exactly to prevent the acquisition and annexation of territory by force. And the third bird that was killed today is the hope that Israel will not fast walk into the full-fledged apartheid. We believe today President Trump has given Israel the full green light to actually embrace a full-fledged apartheid in the occupied territory.
What do you make of the fact that the ambassadors from Oman, Bahrain and the UAE turned up to this event at the White House? Does it not suggest that perhaps you're losing what was once the four-square support of all Arab countries?
No, we're not. And let me hear the Omani or the Emirati or the Bahraini people saying that they are fine with Jerusalem not being under the Palestinian sovereignty.
Well, it suggests that their governments are fine with it.
No, I don't think so. And
Why do you think they turned up to the White House then?
Well, this is their business. This is their business. But we know the official position of the Arab world, and nothing has changed
it is significant. I just wonder if you are really that confident that you retain the undiluted support of all these governments, and one wonders also about what will be the reaction from Saudi Arabia, for example.
We heard from the Arab summits all along the last few months and years, and we heard from the Saudi king several times, who actually named the last summit the summit of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is not just a political issue. Jerusalem has to do with the identity, the history, the civilization, the religion, all that we share with the Arab world.
And the Americans say that they will be offering you parts of Eastern Jerusalem, as they put it, as your capital.
An American president who is so arrogant and ignorant of the situation, he couldn't even pronounce the word Al-Aqsa Mosque. He didn't know how to say it today in his speech. And then he would draw the future of 13 million Palestinians without having one of the 13 million Palestinians in the audience of his ceremony to release his peace plan. I mean, how more of a circus this could be? We Palestinians have accepted the international compromise. We have accepted the logic of establishing a state on 22% of historic Palestine. We have recognized the state of Israel, but we will not accept our full giving up of our rights and our full submission and living second-class citizens in our on our own land. And we are not being difficult here. We are just being principled. We are being patient. We genuinely want to see a peace process that would deliver our rights and the rights of our neighbors, and we'll have peace and security for all. But peace and security cannot be built on the skulls of an entire nation.
Hussam Zomlot, the Palestinian ambassador to London. Well, Egypt called on Palestinians and Israelis to carefully consider Mr. Trump's plan with a view to resuming negotiations. Saudi Arabia said it appreciated Mr. Trump's efforts, but state media announced that King Salman had telephoned the Palestinian president to reassure him of Saudi Arabia's commitment to Palestinian rights. Jordan said the only path to peace was an independent Palestinian state based on its pre-1967 borders, while Turkey dismissed Mr. Trump's proposals as an annexation plan. Other news now, and China has agreed to allow health experts from the World Health Organization to work alongside their Chinese counterparts. They want to get a better understanding of how the coronavirus spreads from person to person, and they want to help find a vaccine. The WHO said the information was urgently needed to coordinate a global response. The Chinese President Xi Jinping said China was sure of defeating the devil coronavirus, which has killed 106 people. But how can he be so confident? Our Asia-Pacific editor is Celia Hatton.
I think this confidence has come out because it has to come out at this point. Xi Jinping has, over the years, put himself at the very pinnacle of the Chinese government. That's made him a very powerful man, but it's also made him quite vulnerable. Every time China faces a major challenge, all eyes look to Xi Jinping because he's ultimately the one who has to solve the problem. It is a bit confusing because a day ago, China's premier, Li Keqiang, who is Xi Jinping's political rival in many ways, appeared on state television. It was said that he had been entrusted by Xi Jinping to direct efforts to deal with the virus. He went to go and visit Wuhan. That's the city at the epicenter of the virus. Today, we have Xi Jinping back in control. He has meeting with the director general of the World Health Organization, appearing to be very, very confident that, the virus will be tackled. He's also said that he personally is directing efforts to prevent the spread of the virus. He personally is deploying resources. So it's an interesting, it's a bit of a mixed message we're getting from the Chinese government, which is quite unusual. Usually their messaging is quite on point. But I think Xi Jinping's really put him back, himself back at the center of all of this.
Yeah, slightly risky for him politically if things go wrong. But I see that a top medical expert in China is predicting the outbreak will peak within 10 days.
Yeah, this is another thing that we saw on Chinese state television playing on their main evening news broadcast. The doctor's name is Zhong Nanshan. He was seen really as the hero or one of the heroes of the SARS epidemic. He's really credited with identifying the SARS virus and really working to stop it where it first broke
back
out.
Back in 2002, 2003.
Exactly. So he's really respected in China. He's seeming a little bit more optimistic than he has in the past. So we're getting this reassuring message over and over again from the state media.
Celia Hatton. The biggest city in Nigeria, Lagos, is to ban commercial motorcycles from many areas, citing overcrowding and safety. In a move that could affect many thousands of commuters, the Lagos state government announced it would stop the bikes, commonly known as okadas, operating in most of the city. Myeni Jones sent us this report from Lagos.
I'm walking alongside a busy intersection in Ikoyi, one of Lagos's most affluent areas. It's evening rush hour and thousands of people are making their way back home from the office. And a number of them are using motorbike taxis known as okadas or commercial tricycles, referred to as KEKIS. But this won't be the case for much longer. Lagos State Government has announced that effective the 1st of February, they will be banning the use of okadas and KEKIS here in Lagos. They say that this is because they cause a lot of chaos and are tied to high casualty figures. The problem is, it's not clear what alternative they will be offering some of Lagos' commuters, many of whom took to social media and to the streets to complain of the fact that a number of times they were able to make appointments or even catch flights because they jumped on an okada or got in a keke. Lagos is a city of 21 million people. There are very few public buses here and no railway infrastructure, so people rely on cars to get to and from work. This causes an enormous amount of traffic. Another major issue is the question of employment. Many of the drivers of these motorbike taxis and tricycles will be left unemployed after the ban. These are all questions that Lagos State Government will have to answer over the next few weeks.
Myeni Jones reporting from Lagos. Still to come, the latest weapon in the battle against malaria in Rwanda, drones. Also,
to watch somebody who was pushing women's athletes to come to an end is hard. But what I'm going to take from it is to push even harder to make sure that my daughter gets what she deserves.
The inspiration that Kobe Bryant provided to fathers. Next, to Spain and the story of a man living with HIV who, 2 years ago, was forced to flee his homeland of Venezuela. The UN estimates that around 8,000 HIV-positive people have been forced to leave the country because of a lack of medicine. It's not uncommon for Venezuelans to experience xenophobia as they search for a new home. But for the LGBT community, it can be even worse, as Tim Smith reports.
It's a critical situation. They are shooting us. They are killing people.
We are without food, without medicines.
The only thing they have is fear, is repression, and is violence.
These voices from inside Venezuela, recorded for a 2017 BBC documentary, paint a picture of a country that has been locked in political and economic crisis for more than 4 years. Millions have left the country due to hyperinflation and shortages of basic goods. But one community has faced a starker choice than most.
Either I leave now or I stay here and I wait for the day I die.
Jose Tobar is 29 years old and has been HIV positive since 2014. He's now living in Spain after he was forced to leave his home when the antiretroviral drugs that keep his illness under control ran out.
Although the political situation was already quite worrying in 2015, you could see that other supplies were missing. Perhaps there was no chemotherapy. The feeling that it could all fall apart at any moment. It was in 2017 when things started to go wrong. For example, I have always taken just one pill, which is a combination of three drugs. But my then partner took three different pills. When he started to only receive two and one wouldn't arrive, or the other one didn't, that was when I decided that I wasn't going to wait to one day get to the hospital and be told, look, we don't have the drugs. In normal situations, in everyday life, LGBT people already face more challenges than the rest of society. It affects us much more because you have to add these problems on top of the fact that you are already an isolated, marginalized group. If you are living in a crisis, all these problems are doubled, or you see them from a more difficult point of view.
You then took the decision to leave and traveled overland to Ecuador. What was life like when you arrived?
Venezuelans already aren't welcome in Ecuador. There's lots of xenophobia. If you're Venezuelan and you're gay, it's like, why don't you go back to your country or carry on to Peru? The culture is different to Venezuelan culture. I lived in Quito, and people there are more close-minded. There's more xenophobia. When you would be leaving a gay club, I experienced this with some friends once. Some guys passed in a car, they threw a bottle at them. One of my friends got cut and they beat him up.
And then after a year and a half of saving, you made your way to Spain and are now receiving your HIV medication from the public health system. How are you finding life here?
En España es totalmente diferente en todo sentido.
In Spain, it's totally different in every way. People are very warm. Wherever you go, you get treated amazingly well. Also, in no place do you feel discrimination or xenophobia directed at you. But most importantly, when you go somewhere, you receive amazing treatment. You're like, is this real or is there a hidden camera somewhere? For me, this has been the most unusual part. That a person working in the public sector treats you so well is so bizarre for me. Therefore, if something were to happen to you in the street, which has never happened to me, thank God, when you arrive at one of these places and you receive quality treatment, it makes you feel even better than you were before. Since I got to Spain, I've been feeling so much better. I'm really happy.
And that report from Spain by Tim Smith. Rwanda has started using drones to spray insecticides at mosquito breeding sites. It's already used drones to supply blood to remote health centres. Mary Harper reports.
Rwanda says the drones will be loaded with insecticide and flown to hard-to-reach areas such as swamps, marshes and rice paddies. The chemical will target malarial mosquitoes at their larval stage. Officials say the insecticide is not harmful to people or crops. The Health Ministry says the initiative will help Rwanda achieve its target of having zero malaria cases. Nearly 4 million people have been diagnosed with malaria in Rwanda in the past 2 years, although the number of deaths is declining.
Mary Harper. Armando Iannucci is one of the most influential satirists working today. His sitcoms Veep and The Thick of It are considered two of the sharpest political comedies ever made. But he's now stepped away from mocking British and American politics with his latest film, an adaptation of the classic Charles Dickens novel David Copperfield.
This narrative is far more than mere fiction.
Are you David Copperfield?
I am indeed.
It is the true story of the life I was about to lead.
Your mama is ill.
How ill is she?
Very ill.
Dangerously ill.
She's dead.
A moment from the personal history of David Copperfield, directed by Armando Iannucci and starring Dev Patel, best known for Slumdog Millionaire and Lion. He's an actor of Indian descent, while the character of David Copperfield, based on Dickens himself, is not. Armando Iannucci has been explaining to Dan Damon his reasons for casting Dev Patel in the title role.
It all started from my thinking, who is David Copperfield? Who do I want to play David? He's in every scene in this film. Who would be the perfect person to play? And the only person I could think of was Dev Patel, because he combined that, he had that combination of the naivety and innocence and gawkiness that we saw when he started off in Skins, to that strength and charisma that he has in films like Lion. And he's in every scene. He has to play slapstick, drama, pathos, melodrama. He has to impersonate the other characters around him. It's a huge comic and acting turn, and he pulls it off wonderfully. And I'm just so delighted that the first things the critics and reviewers and the audiences have been saying is how David Copperfield is Dev Patel, and Dev Patel is David Copperfield. So that, starting with that, you then think, so how do I cast everyone else? And I thought, well, I chose Dev because he's the best person available for the part, and that's how I will cast the other parts. Why should I not be allowed to draw from 100% of the acting talent available to me?
You've changed the motherlode a bit, haven't you? You're not satirising modern politics in the way that you did in The Thick of It or The Day-to-Day. Why is that?
Well, A, I've been doing that. Things like Thick of It and Veep, I've been doing that for about 10 years, and I thought it was time to move on. But also, I think, you know, the language of the last 2 or 3 years, especially about the UK, has become very extreme and angry and discordant, really. It's so easy to talk about Britain as if it's a very insular, isolated, inward-looking country. And A, I didn't feel I wanted to add to that discordant conversation, but also I wanted to celebrate what I think Britain is, which is actually an outgoing, generous, warm-hearted, open-minded, kind and humorous country.
Is this the post-Brexit Iannucci that we're hearing?
Well, I mean, I think in a way, yes, because I think I've been affected by just the levels of extreme. I think we've lost the ability to disagree with each other civilly now. And we've reached the stage where if I say one thing and you say another and it's the opposite of what I believe, instead of my arguing with you about it, I say, well, I don't feel safe with you here. Could you leave, please? You know, that's the extent we've got to. And I think we've lost that ability to reach out. We have to reach out and connect with people who share, who don't share all our views, who may think something different. Otherwise, we're going to end up enclosed in our own little, you know, little islands of belief.
Film director Armando Iannucci. Tributes to the basketball player Kobe Bryant have continued to pour in after his death in a helicopter crash on Sunday near Los Angeles. His 13-year-old daughter Gianna was one of the eight others who died. She was a talented basketball player herself, and much has been made of her father's support for women's sport. The hashtag GirlDad has been trending on Twitter, with fathers posting photos with their daughters. It all began after ESPN sports presenter Elle Duncan praised Bryant.
I met Kobe one time, backstage at an event for ESPN in New York, and I saw him and I thought, oh my gosh. As I approached him, he immediately commented on my rather large 8-month pregnant belly. How are you? How close are you? What are you having? A girl, I said, and then he high-fived me. Girls are the best. I asked him for advice on raising girls, seeing as though he quite famously had three at the time, and he said, just be grateful that you've been given that gift because girls are amazing. I'm a girl dad. When it came to sports, he said that his oldest daughter was an accomplished volleyball player and that the youngest was a toddler. But that middle one, he said, that middle one was a monster. She's a beast. She's better than I was at her age. She's got it. I suppose that the only small source of comfort for me is knowing that he died doing what he loved the most, being a dad, being a girl dad.
Elle Duncan on Kobe Bryant. Well, the BBC's outside source decided to find out how Kobe Bryant had inspired three American girl dads. Divya Arya brought together Brandon in California, John in Pennsylvania, and first Dylan in Texas.
It's hard because I am a girl dad. I've got one son, but I've got two daughters, and I've got a middle daughter that plays soccer, and she's got the nickname Little Messi. And to hear that statement of she's better than me is a true statement. She's better than me. I grew up playing soccer, and it's amazing just to watch somebody who was pushing women's athletes and athletics to be that, and for it to just come to an end is hard. But what I'm going to take from it is to push even harder to make sure that my daughter gets what she deserves.
Brandon?
My youngest daughter is 8 years old, and her name is actually Gianna. And Gianna came to be from Kobe's daughter. And it makes me emotional seeing him and listening to what they've been saying and how raising girls, I always thought that, you know, they were just supposed to, you know, be like the cheerleader or something on the sideline. But when my oldest, Nye, told me that, you know, she wanted to be on the court. She was the one who wanted to play basketball. And seeing Kobe Bryant and his daughters, I'm like, you know what? You can do it. You can play basketball. You don't have to just be the person that cheers on the other people playing. You know, you can do anything that you want to do. It was a huge inspiration to me and countless others. And I just hope that that we can just keep continuing the legacy and these all these fathers that are on now with raising our girls the way that he raised his girls, with giving them the confidence and the strength to do anything that they wanted.
Hi, and this is John from Pennsylvania. This is a really wonderful thing to talk with some other girl dads. And my girls didn't play sports, but they have visions for what they want to do, and I've supported them 100% all the way. The older one came to me at 13 and said she wanted to be valedictorian of her high school class, and she accomplished that. Then she said, I'm going to go to Temple and I'm going to have a 4.0. I said, okay, you do what you want to do, and she did that. And also at 13 is when she decided she was going to eventually work for the Walt Disney Company. And she is.
That right there, I mean, that says a lot, because, you know, having a girl that's, you know, 12 years old and just trying to prove herself on a field, but having your daughter do what she said that she was set out to do, that's a role model in itself. And John, I mean, dude, that's an amazing accomplishment. And that's a story that I'll share today with my daughter, that you can do anything. You set your mind to it, you can do your thing. And that's what this brings us together. I mean, here we are, three random dads in the United States who knew nothing about each other, but yet here we are having a conversation about our daughters who,
you even think about it 10 years ago, we're not really thinking like we are now. And it's just Kobe and them and everybody else that's doing this thing for women and sports and women in the field. It's just an amazing thing, and it's powerful. It's not only touching here, it's touching worldwide.
This man reached us all, and the fact that he made us better and he's showing young ladies that they can do anything they want is just, it's truly, it's just, I'm damn near speechless.
Yeah, it really makes you proud to be a girl dad. And I always was, but, you know, the girl dads are kind of stepping out now and just showing their pride in their children. And God bless you guys. I'm sure your kids are much younger than mine are. And you've got a long way to go to enjoy every minute and encourage whatever they want to do, you know. Mine is an art student, and, you know, people say art. I said, she's going to figure it out. I'm not going to – this child has a talent and a skill exactly. that she wants to grow, and I'm not going to be the one that says, you can't do that, because you know what? You can do that.
I had a chance back when my daughter Avery, who's 12, and she was just young. She was just born, and I had a chance to actually go down and shoot a local Spurs game here, and the Lakers were in town. And we all know this. When the Lakers are in town, everybody's going to stop what they're doing, and I had a chance to cover them, and I was able to be the first photographer in there, and I was right there about a foot away from him. Went through the interview, and I just told Kobe, I said, well, I'm trying to do stuff and trying to prove myself for my daughter. And he's like, oh, you got daughters, huh? And I said, yeah, I got one right now. And he goes, they are the greatest gift that you could ever have, and they will change your life about everything. And I hope to God that you're always there for her. And he winked at me. That Kobe wink that I see on videos right now, it gets me because I got that wink. And it was only the, you know, 5 minutes of being around this man. And it was just right there. That moment for me just changed me on how I looked at having a daughter compared to having a son.
John, Brandon and Dylan, three girl dads on how they were inspired by Kobe Bryant. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.